Joshua did. He's a greater priest in that his priesthood is permanent. His sacrifice is once for all and therefore effective. And it is the means by which a better covenant is established. And so, superior priesthood, superior sacrifice, superior covenant. And now he's making the final push for them to remain faithful to the Lord, to hold on to their hope in Christ Jesus. And they have been, of course, tempted to go back to the old law, go back to the law of Moses, to what they knew. That's what. In a moment of crisis, people default to what they know. And so it's perhaps not surprising. But he's encouraging them to go back, but not to that. To go back to faith. Go back to faith in God. Go back to faith that was around even before the law was around. To go back to the things that God has always wanted, and that is people who love him and trust him absolutely. And so that's really what Hebrews 11 is about. He's tying them into this heritage of faith that transcends the law, because this faith was around before the law and it's around after the law. And so it's manifestly greater than the law of Moses. And so he's calling them back to that. He's used a number of examples to point to that. In Hebrews 11, in verse 3, or I'm sorry, in verse 6, he says, "By faith it is impossible, without faith it is impossible to please him. For he who comes to God must believe that he is, and that he is a rewarder for those who seek him." And so the thing that all of these people have in common, Abel and Enoch, we looked at last time, and Noah, and everybody else that we're going to talk about, the thing that they have in common is that they knew God. They knew that God was, and they knew that God was a rewarder of those who seek him. And they acted on that knowledge. They acted with confidence in the knowledge that God would, in fact, do what he said he was going to do, and he would reward them, even though, this is the key thing, is they didn't have any tangible, visible evidence of that in front of them at that time, the time they showed their faith. It was they had faith in that which was not seen. I mean, it was without evidence, but it was not yet seen. And we talked about, we were back in the last time, we talked about the fact that Noah built the ark even though he'd never seen the flood, because God said it was coming. So he believed that was going to happen. And he believed that what God had told him would be the only way that he would be delivered from that coming judgment. And so he acted in confidence that doing what God said would, in fact, be the means of his deliverance. And then, of course, next he turns to Abraham. Abraham is the sort of the father of it all. And before we dive into Abraham, let's think just a little bit about why Abraham and Sarah get quite a bit of space here in this chapter. Why might Abraham and then Isaac, Jacob, Joseph, why might Abraham be particularly important in this line? faith initially to Abraham, and those promises are still, of course, being fulfilled in Jesus Christ. And so his faith in those promises is particularly important because those same promises are ultimately finally realized in Jesus Christ. And so Abraham is really important in that sense. So to think about the Hebrew writers are making some specific points about some of the spiritual aspects of Abraham's hope. But he's thinking about, for instance, the promise in Abraham's seed or in Abraham's descendants, all the nations of the earth would be blessed. Now, of course, that's realized provisionally through his descendants on a number of occasions. But how is that ultimately, finally realized? Before you fall into legends. Through whom is that ultimately, finally realized? Jesus. Okay. And so, Abraham is particularly important in that sense, in that there's a very real connection between the Hebrew writer's audience and Abraham, not because they're Jews, but because they're Christians. And so there's likewise a very real connection between us and Abraham. Again, Paul makes that point at the end of Galatians 3, that it is those who have had faith in Christ Jesus who all are the descendants of Abraham, the children of Abraham. Well, and so Abraham is pretty important. Now let's look at some of the things that he did. Here, by faith, Abraham, when he was called, obeyed by going out to a place which he was to receive for an inheritance. And he went out not knowing where he was going. By faith, he lived as an alien in the land of promise, as in a foreign land, dwelling in tents with Isaac and Jacob, fellow heirs of the same promise. For he was looking for the city which has foundations, whose architect and builder is God. And so, Abraham goes out to this land, and how much of the land that God promised Abraham was given to Abraham during his lifetime? None. Exactly so. None. He got nothing. Remember, there's kind of a big deal made in Genesis 25 when Sarah dies. Abraham has to do what? In order to bury it. Yeah, he has to buy a piece of land, which is hugely significant that he buys a piece of land in Canaan to bury Sarah, because where do people usually go to be buried? Home. They want to go home. And so when Abraham buys a piece of land in Canaan to bury Sarah, what does that indicate that he feels about him? Yeah, that's his home. That's his home. And we're going to see that becomes a theme that the Hebrew writers are going to do quite a bit with that as we move on from here. But that is immensely significant. He goes into this land. He's wandering through this stranger. He doesn't have any of it. And yet, he encounters it. Indicates by his remaining there and by his actions that he believes in the promises of God. Now this statement is made that he's looking for what kind of cities in verse 10. Okay, he's building an architect of God, so that would be a physical city? No, he's looking for a spiritual inheritance. He's looking for an inheritance that transcends this life. And so, why do you think the Hebrew writer couldn't when Genesis doesn't come right out and say that, does it? I don't know if we know this absolutely, but let me suggest something. Again, Abraham never received even an inch of land during his lifetime. And yet, he went down and he sojourned in that land the entire time. He left everything that he knew behind him. He went down and sojourned in that land. And so, the Hebrew writer seems to be arguing, he must believe there was some reward, and since that reward didn't come in this life, then he must have been looking for it in the next life. That seems implicit in his actions. And so he's looking for a spiritual city. Now, later on, the Hebrew writer is going to come back to that. And he is going to tell them and us, you have come to Mount Zion, the city of the living God, the heaven of Jerusalem, and you've done Hebrews 12:22. So that city he's talking about, he doesn't just sort of bring that up and drop it. That's important. And he's going to come back to that concept. He lived as an alien in the land as a stranger. And so he has part of his faith was the fact that he really doesn't belong in the land. And a lot of the things that go on in the land are alien to him. Think about a couple of, this is maybe not, there are a number of incidents that sort of point to this. Why does Abraham say in Genesis 20, why does Abraham say that he lied about Sarah? You get that's not a high point, but there's a point to be made.
Did he say first he knew she was beautiful?
Okay, yes. But your understanding and faith that is being described. Sarah received ability to conceive. Now, notice that this is by faith in Sarah herself received ability to conceive, even beyond the proper time of life, since she considered him faithful who had promised. Now, that's an interesting statement. She considered him faithful who had promised. What did Sarah do in Genesis 18 when she overheard the messenger, the visitor, I guess, tell Abraham that his wife was going to bear a child? What did she do? She laughed. And then, of course, she's called in part for laughing. And then she's afraid. But she had some doubts about this. But she believes that God will in fact make the descendants as numerous as the stars in heaven. That's a quotation from Genesis 22:17. So this God fulfills this promise, but she's a little rocky there. And again, why would the Hebrew writer, why use this example? Of all the examples he could use, why use this example? I mean, surely he could have done better than this, right? Somebody hears the promise of God and says, ah, yeah, right. That's the faith you want to highlight.
Thank you.
think she's going to have a child. So she's trying to raise up an heir some other way. And so he's been having some long thoughts about ever producing an offspring for Abraham for a good long time now. This is not a momentary glitch. She's been struggling for a long time now. But kept on, kept going, and is rewarded with the fulfillment, at least the promise of a child. Then he makes this point here about Abraham and Sarah and encouraging the father. All these died in faith without receiving the promises. Are Abraham's descendants as numerous as the stars in the sky when he dies? No. And he got out of the land, and maybe to some degree his descendants have been a blessing to the people around him in some small way in their service to God, but he doesn't have a great name. He really doesn't see much of what God has promised fulfilled yet. Now, God told him all that. He told him in the distant future. But he says, all these died in faith without receiving the promises. But having seen them, having welcomed them from a distance, and having confessed that they were strangers and exiles on the earth, again, by their continued faithfulness to the Lord, they are confessing that they knew and understood that their reward was not in the here and now. Those who say such things make it clear that they are seeking their country, not their own. And he says, indeed, if they, and this is 15 is key for the Hebrew writer audience. Indeed, if they had been thinking of that country from which they went out, they would have had opportunity to return. Okay? If they wanted an earthly reward, Abraham could have gone back to Haran. He could have gone back to Ur of the Chaldeans. He could have gone back where he came from, where he had all his connections, where he had his family. And if that's what he was looking for, he had the opportunity to go back. And that's a particularly powerful argument, because it also sort of evokes thoughts about another generation of God's people, the Israelites in the wilderness. And where were they? What were they always wanting to do? Yeah, go back. Go back to Egypt. Let's go back to Egypt. We need to go back to Egypt. They brought that up and they said, no, let's go back to Egypt. Better than Egypt. We remember when we sat by the pots full of meat and we had all these sons, all this good food. And boy, it was great. I miss the brick factory so much. And it was just a wonderful place to be. And Pharaoh was such a good boss. And it was a grand old time back there in Egypt. And, they want to go back. They go back to their slavery. And Abraham could have gone back, but he doesn't go back. Now, what is the Hebrew writer's audience thinking about doing? They're thinking about going back. Not geographically, of course, but theologically. They're thinking about going back to the law of Moses. They're thinking about going back to where they came from, the Judaism that came out of it. They find themselves wandering in the wilderness, just like Abraham, or just like the Israelites. And so he's really presenting them with a choice. Are you going to So, way back in Genesis 17, 19, not only there, but as far back as that, Abraham was told that the promise is going to be fulfilled through Isaac. Okay? So, when Abraham was told, Genesis 22, to kill Isaac, what else is he killing besides his son? Potentially. Yeah, he's killing promises. He's killing any possibility that the promises are going to be fulfilled because God has told him, that his descendants are going to come through Isaac. And then God has told him to kill Isaac. So, that doesn't make any sense. That can't be right. What is the only explanation for Abraham following through and killing Isaac? Yes. Faith. He doesn't know. He has an idea that he would write and tell us. He doesn't know how God is going to work this out. But he knows God. And so, that doesn't make any sense to me. I don't understand, but this is what God's wanting to do, and so I'm going to do it, and I'm going to trust him to work it out. child will sow to the younger, and the promises are going to come to the younger. But if you remember that whole, how is it that Jacob came to get the blessing that God intended for him to have? He deceived him. That's exactly right. He deceived his father and his brother, who lived up to his name, as a planter. And he deceived his father and stole the blessing. Isaac was not a little upset by that. But it did in fact. So again, it's kind of it's not a perfectly executed faith, but the Hebrew writer is not so concerned with the details as it is this key fact. And that is that Isaac believes that his sons are in fact going to inherit the promises that God has made to Abraham and Isaac and now to Jacob and to some degree. Going to come to Jacob, and he pronounces these blessings in accordance with that belief. God is going to do what he said he's going to do, and that again, the realization of those things are going to happen beyond the scope of Isaac's life. So yeah, it's not neat and pretty, but he's looking beyond, looking to the promises. And then, Jacob, there are a couple of examples that are cited about Jacob here. He says, Jacob, as he was dying, blessed the sons of Joseph and worshiped, leaning on top of his staff. And so, in Genesis 47, we have him leaning on the top of the staff. Let's look at these really quickly and see what happens on these two occasions. In Genesis 47, beginning verse 29, it says, when the time for Israel to die drew near, he called his son Joseph and said, please, if I have found favor in your sight, place now your hand under my thigh and deal with me in kindness and faithfulness. Please do not bury me in Egypt. But when I lie down with my fathers, you shall carry me out of Egypt and bury me in their burial place. And he said, I will do as you said. And he said, swear to me. And then Israel bowed in worship at the head of the bed. And so, why? I mean, are you kidding me? Jacob lives in the greatest cemetery in the world. Right? I mean, still, who has the coolest headstones on the entire planet? It's the pharaohs, dude. See the pyramids, right? I mean, that's the greatest graveyard in the whole world. You know, I don't want to be buried here. We'll see what we do with the pyramid. But still, I mean, why does he want to go back to that? It's home. And it's home not because they have it. Not only do they not have it, they don't even have anybody there anymore. There's some dead people there. But the whole family's in Egypt now. Egypt is their home now. No. That's the promised land. And so when Jacob says, take me back there and bury me there, it is a declaration that he believes, even though they're in Egypt now, he believes that God is going to fulfill promises. And so he wants to be buried in the cave of Machpelah. That's the second, third, fourth, fifth episode. We'll stop there. We'll look next time at him blessing Joseph's son.